Marx follows the ever-changing landscape to discuss the latest pressing issues relevant to brand owners in Europe and beyond. During this series, Marx members and special guests share updates, experiences, and opinions. This is IP Law Today. This is Talking Marx.
Welcome to the third episode of the Talking Marx podcast. I'm James Nurton, and today I'm joined by two members of the Marx Dispute Resolution Team to talk about some of the key CJEU trademark judgments from 2020. And they are Marianne Hollands, a lawyer from Berggren Oy in Finland, and Konstantin Kletzer, a partner of Geistwirth Attorneys at Law in Austria. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
So today we're going to try and look at five cases from the past year during the podcast, starting with one that was decided back in January 2020. Konstantin, can you tell us a bit about the Skykick case?
Yes, pleasure. Thank you very much, James, for the introduction. Hello, everybody. I'm starting off with the Sky decision of the Court of Justice. I refer to the Court of Justice of the European Union as the court. I think that's the simplest way to do it. So this case was a referral from the High Court of Justice of England and Wales regarding a practice actually quite widely used by applicants with the EU IPO, namely claiming an, let's say, overly extensive specification of goods and services in trademark applications. We all know those specifications, pages long. Yeah, just imagine how the examiners feel about it. So the High Court asked the court several questions, and I want to highlight two of them. The first one being whether a trademark may be declared invalid on the ground that some or all of the terms of the specification of goods and services are lacking sufficient clarity and precision. So the question is relating actually to the whether the IP translator requirements may be a ground for nullifying for declaring valid a trademark. The court said no to this. A trademark cannot be declared invalid on those grounds because this would be an extra ground of invalidity, which is not provided in the exhaustive list in the trademark regulation and the trademark directives. The second question was whether it is bad faith to apply for a trademark without any intention to use it in relation to the specified goods and services. Here, the court confirmed, yes, this might be a bad faith practice. However, only under certain conditions. You have to keep in mind that applicants at the time they are filing a trademark naturally do not precisely know how they will use their trademark in to which extent, for which goods and services they will use the trademark. This cannot be bad faith, sir. However, bad faith kicks in where it is apparent that the trademark owner has filed it with no aim to engaging in on the market or in competition, but with the intention of undermining the interests of competitors, for instance, or with the intention of obtaining an exclusive right for other purposes than those falling within the function of a trademark. So the court here very interestingly also referred to the function theory. Yeah, so far from reporting about the case, and I think we can hand over to Marianne for some conclusions.
Thanks, Konstantin. Yeah, I have a few comments, and please comment back if you have different ideas. But in my opinion, this was for sure one of the most important and interesting cases of last year, especially as the sufficient clarity of the classification has been under discussion since the IP translator case in this area. All in all, I think that the decision was good news for the trademark holders who have already filed applications or registrations with WAKE classification, because this decision kind of removes the risk for invalidation actions or application based on unclear classification. And it was also a good reminder that we cannot invent new grounds for invalidation. So it is an exhaustive list, and we cannot really try to make new grounds there just because we think that this might be something that should be possible in a way. So I think that the question still remains that should this insufficient clarity in a classification be a ground for invalidation? I think that the trademark holder's perspective is quite clear that no. And I kind of tend to agree with it because we do have potential other ways to approach this challenge. For instance, perhaps the non-use applications or invalidations can be used, or also in opposition proceedings, you will need to show the actual use of the mark. So there might be some replies to this challenge already. Of course, there is still some inequality that will remain between the old registrations and the newer ones. So let's see if this will evolve in the future a bit more.
And on the bad faith point, Marianne, very briefly.
Yeah. As regards this issue, I think it was good that it was addressed, and I think it was kind of even innovative to look at the classifications from this point of view. To be honest, I'm a bit skeptic whether this would change anything in practice, because the trademark holders might still seek as broad protection as possible, even if they wouldn't have a clear intention to use the mark for all of the goods and services that they apply for. Because in some cases, it might be just strategically good to do so. And especially because it might be really difficult to prove in practice what is the intention or has been the intention of the trademark owner at the application stage. So I'm sure there are cases where it might be quite apparent, as the court said, that the classification has been chosen to be so broad only due to some unfair strategies. But I think that in most cases, it might be quite difficult to prove. But of course, to some extent, it may decrease the amount of overly broad applications. I think that in some cases, the applicants may reconsider whether they want to risk facing invalidation actions based on bad faith. And also, this might give some tools for amicable solutions to overcome conflicts between marks.
So overall, I think it was a relief for trademark owners and a decision that was broadly welcomed.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Good. Thank you very much for discussing that. So we're going to move on to the second case, which is actually one from Finland. So Marianne, I think you're going to introduce this one.
Yeah, thank you, James. So this was a case where it concerned actually a counterfeit issue, the ECJ decision of 772/18. So the case facts were that a resident of Finland, let's say Mr. A, received a consignment from China containing 150 ball bearings for spare parts, and this amount is quite big, and it's quite apparent that these goods were not meant for private use. Each one of these ball bearings were marked with a counterfeit trademark, and the goods were released from customs to the Mr. A. Then Mr. A kept the goods at his home, after which he sent a consignment of the goods to Russia. So Mr. A's only involvement was that he storaged the infringed goods as an intermediary and completing the customs papers. In return, he actually didn't receive any other compensation, no money, but only cigars and cognac, so spirits. But the Finnish Supreme Court then sent this case to the Court of Justice, and the main issue in the questions and the case was that whether this mere storing by a private person could be considered to be used in trade in the course of trade as required by the counterfeit regulations, and especially if the remuneration is insignificant, the amount of the remuneration that the intermediary receives. Firstly, the Court of Justice examined whether the condition of trademark infringements is concerning the use in the course of trade is determined based on objective factors. And in this case, the Court of Justice said that it's apparent that the infringing goods, due to their nature and volume, were not intended for a private use. Therefore, the transaction with those goods falls within a trading business. Secondly, the court stated that the significance of the economic remuneration for retaining infringing goods was not relevant to determine whether a trademark was used in the course of trade or not. Thirdly, the court stated that the importing of trademark goods may occur, although they were not imported at the importer's request. So in this case, it was deemed sufficient that the person, in this case Mr. A, provided his address to a dealer, then retained goods for some weeks on behalf of the dealer, and then shipped them to a country outside the EU with an aim at reselling them. So the fact that the person has imported and released for free circulation such goods that are not meant for private use justifies in itself a finding that that person has acted in the course of trade. So based on all of this, the Court of Justice concluded that using a trademark in the course of trade includes accepting a delivery and retaining the infringed goods for the benefit of a third party in order to sell them to Russia, even though this is done by an intermediary who is not professionally engaged in the trade.
So another welcome decision, really, for trademark owners.
Yeah, I think it was. But on the other hand, I also got the feeling that if these goods that would have been something like clothes or something that could have been used in private use, they might have, could have been assessed differently.
Thank you, Marianne. Constantine, I know you want to mention another case at this point that's relevant here.
Yeah, the case is involving Coty and yet against Amazon again. What would we do without Coty, which is a Marks member, certainly? I think European trademark law would not be that highly developed without Coty. What is it about? Subject matter of the case was Coty being a plaintiff, distribute Davidoff-branded perfumes. On the other hand, we have actually two Amazon Group companies being accused by Coty of storing Davidoff hot water perfumes and by handing them to delivery companies on behalf of third parties, actually marketplace shops acting on the Amazon marketplace website. So precisely this is not about Amazon being liable for support acts by providing the Amazon marketplace, but for simple storage of the products for the purpose of offering them for sale or putting them on the market by third parties. So the court stated that for such simple storage, there is no liability of Amazon because it's not an active behavior and there is no direct or indirect control of the use act. And this is actually, it might be surprising at first, but it's actually in line with the decision of the court in the online world with L'Oreal eBay, where the provider of an online marketplace does not use the trademarks that appear within the eBay offers. However, certainly liability of such storage holder would be given if the person storing the products would aim to offer the goods for sale by himself. So the court distinguishes between whether the person storing the goods aims to market them by himself or hands it over to third parties, which when I first read that, it seemed a little bit odd, but dogmatically is actually correct. And any cases of potential circumvention would be absorbed by the fact that if the person storing the products is aware of the infringement, of the trademark infringement, or is being made aware by the trademark owner in a notice and takedown process, there would be liability would be given and this a court decision wouldn't apply. And still, apart from that, there's also the liability of intermediaries under the enforcement directive, which would safeguard proper liability of infringers for the trademark owner. And so I think this is a fair balance, actually.
And it does seem, Marianne, like there's more and more of these cases involving intermediaries, and we're going to see the law continue to evolve in this area.
Yeah, sure. And I think also that the different solution in this case would have been a bit of a nightmare for online marketplaces. So I think it's a good decision in this area.
So moving on to our next case, and I should warn any listeners of a sensitive disposition that this does involve some interesting language, doesn't it, Constantine?
Yeah. Actually, this case is about two words usually not used or spoken out loud. Yeah, it's containing the F word. The applicant here was seeking registration for the word sign, and I'm only going to say it once, Fuck You Goethe, which is spelled F-A-C-K and J-U, and then Goethe as Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. So for various goods around the classification, It was rejected by the EUIPO and the General Court because being against the accepted principles of morality, which at the first sight seems fairly okay. But it went up to the court, and the court said, well, there is no definition of what's accepted principles of morality. And he did that definition. I'm going to spare it at this point. You can read that in the decision. But the important part is that there is has to be regarded a social context and also a context of time. Different times and different social contexts can generate different principles, let's say it like that. So, and here it was the case that this phrase, which was requested as a trademark, is also the title of comedic film series, very well known in German-speaking public. The movie under that title was even played in schools and used by the famous Goethe Institute even for educational purposes. So the court referred that case back and said, well, dear office, dear general court, you have not considered these special circumstances, this special social context, which gave this trademark a different meaning. I think a totally correct decision for me as a German-speaking person might be different in other countries.
Marianne, what do you think as a non-native German speaker?
Well, for me, it's I think it may look like a sure immoral mark, but I think it's nice that the decision highlights the fact that the relevant public is an important factor in this case, that we cannot really kind of forget the cultural differences. I'm not sure whether this would have gone through in Finland, but it was a fun decision, I think, in that sense also.
It certainly was. And this topic of morality and offensiveness is one that we often return to at Marx, isn't it, with the work of the teams and in the conferences as well. I know there are always interesting sessions to look at some of the Marx that are either accepted or rejected.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's always very well-attended workshops which are dealing with those trademarks, strangely. I don't know why.
So the final case we're going to discuss properly is one on the likelihood of confusion, isn't it? And Marianne, you're going to summarize this.
Yeah. So it was a position case of the concerning two trademarks, CCB and CB. I'm not going to go into full details of the case, but I think it's enough to say that the applicant, the China Construction Bank, filed for a figurative mark, CCB. And then the opponent had a prior registration for CB, which was also a figurative mark. In my opinion, the marks were, in terms of their figurative elements, quite different. But because the opposition was based on also on reputation and not just due to the similarity of the marks, the first Board of Appeal kind of made an assumption that as the CB was due to the reputation accrued to it, it kind of made the dominant element of the mark as well. So they kind of just draw an assumption that the reputation would somehow also reflect the dominant elements of the marks. And the Court of Justice said that this is not the case. They said that it was incorrect to assess the similarity of the marks in light of the reputation in the earlier mark. Was the identification of a dominant element in a sign may be relevant for the purposes of comparing the signs at issue, it did not follow that the existence of reputation makes it possible to determine which element is dominant in the minds of the relevant consumers. So the Court of Justice said that the reputation and enhanced distinctive character are not relevant to the assessment of similarity of the signs and should only be considered in the assessment of likelihood of confusion. So this is very important because if the marks are not held to be similar, there can be no likelihood of confusion either.
Thank you very much, Marianne. Constantine, what do you take from this judgment?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. It's definitely, they didn't tell us anything new. It's no landmark decision, but it's still something we forget in the daily routine when assessing danger of confusion of two signs. There is no infringement if there is no similarity. This is a black and white criterion. The same applies actually also for similarity of goods and services. If there is no similarity, there is no infringement. So I think that's something which when doing the test, everybody has to bear in mind. We sometimes forget that and think we can tweak around it. But at the end of the day, that's very clear.
Thank you. So we've covered the five cases that we thought were the most interesting that we wanted to highlight in this podcast. Just as a little bonus for our listeners, I'm going to ask each speaker to just say maybe in one sentence if there's any other case that they would recommend people perhaps look at from last year and why that might be interesting. So as briefly as you can, Marianne, is there one other case that you would identify?
Well, I took note of the Primart case where the ECJ kind of perhaps gave a way for a more stricter approach towards weak marks. So I feel that sometimes if you said get a registration for a weak mark, it gets a really broad protection, even broader than it perhaps should. So this decision by the Court of Justice can kind of give a better view on the weak marks as we have maybe been used to lately.
Interesting. Very good. Thank you. And what about you, Konstantin? Is there one case that you would recommend people look at?
Yeah, just would like to highlight the Gumbug case, which is a case about a 3D trademark, which together with the TripTrap decision actually now forms quite a good setup for criteria to file 3D trademarks. And I think it's within that framework, it's kind of an art of filing trademarks. You really need to know what you're doing. You need to also shape your environment as a trademark holder with the right marketing claims in your marketing material, not to jeopardize your trademark filing. That's very interesting to read, to dig into if you are into 3D trademarks.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks to both of you for talking us through those cases. You've done a great job in covering some really interesting issues in the short period we have. I think we will have a blog post on the Class 46 blog on the Marks website, where we'll provide links to all the cases, all the judgments that we've discussed today. So if you want to find out more and read the cases in full, do have a look at that. But for today, that concludes the third episode of the Talking Marks podcast. Thank you very much to our speakers. Thank you to everyone for listening. And look out for the next episode coming next month.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, James.
Thank you, everybody.
Join us again soon for another podcast on an important issue for brand owners. To find out more on our website and guest speakers, visit marks.org/podcast.